This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences and the humanities. Together with Sharad Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks and social phenomena, the better to understand how society works. Each week we discuss a classic text, theme or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. This week, Sharad, we're going to talk about fetishes.
Well, you know, I have a very commonplace notion of fetish. I think we've, in some respects, have touched on the question of fetishes along the way as you explored Freud with us.
And Marx, too. We did a discussion on a commodity fetish, which we'll touch on today as well.
And is there a connection between the two kind of notions of the fetish? Because I'm thinking one in terms of, you know, people who... for whom an object becomes, something of an obsession. The people kind of love your ankle, or they love all ankles, regardless of who it's connected to. You know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
They both have different emphases, but critical theory is going to try to bridge them together. Marx and Freud were writing in different times. They were focusing on different questions with regards to the fetish. But subsequent theorists like the Frankfurt School or even recent critics of ideology are going to bring Marx and Freud together and try to find ways that their insights can help fill in the gaps of their respective theories. So there is a connection. But fundamentally, they both share this observation that human beings have a particular affinity to objects in a very personalized way. On one hand, like you said, we know of the common sexual fetishes. Ankles would be one of them. People have finger fetishes, feet fetishes, so on and so forth.
Shoes, objects, right?
Shoes, diaper fetishes. But what this has in common in a broader general pattern of behavior is that ultimately we all have some sort of attachment to objects in the sense that we see ourselves or we see our desire fixed on these things. And this is where the two of them, even though they're going to take the theories in different directions, start their observations with.
Are we going to be anchoring this in a particular text, or is it going to be wide-ranging?
It's going to be wide-ranging because the discussion has grown beyond these two thinkers in the sense that a lot of subsequent theorists are going to do different things with it.
Okay, and is it related to Hari Raya? I mean, is there a connection? Is there a ketupat fetish, for instance? No?
Well, to start with, this is where both of them would have something in common in the sense that they see religion as a site for plenty of examples of fetishes. So think of the cross, for example, right? It's just wood or plastic or even an image, right, put together. But clearly, it's at the same time more than just an image or pieces of wood, right?
But wouldn't the faithful say, well, in that, the relationship might be better captured by the word, say, veneration? So you venerate, the objects, or you venerate, what the object stands for. In this case, if it's the cross, it's a particular moment in that narrative of Christ becoming, as he were, returning to his place within the Holy Trinity or whatever.
Oh, no, definitely. That narrative would be included in our understanding of the cross, for example. Clearly, it comes out of certain historical events and these events resonate to us today. But the question in terms of understanding fetishism is why must that significance be objectified, put into material form, and why is there a deep attachment to it? And this is where the Marxian theory would use that same term in the same way as a Freudian would.
So it's not a pejorative. It's not necessarily a bad thing to say, oh, you have a fetish. Or fetishes are not necessarily some oddity, an odd or perverse behavior. They're just actually part of the human repertoire. I mean,
Let's start off with the claim that at least for these two, Freud and Marx, there is a certain problem with it. So for Marx, it reflects alienation that humans have with the objects in their world. And for Freud, it is a kind of perversion. But Freud uses the term perversion in not as a pejorative necessarily, anything that deviates from the norm of the evolutionary process. So being drawn to shoes or diapers will not help the evolutionary process in the way, say, the norms of genital copulation would. So he was trying to really think along these lines. So understanding how it is and where and when and why human beings would deviate from the evolutionary matrix. So they both would have issues with it. But subsequent theorists like Lacan, for example, would not cast it in these terms. So he's going to have a more expansive notion of it. But for starters, let's just note the peculiarity of this. And let's not just limit our understanding to religious objects or sexual objects, but also everyday objects, right? My attachment to my car, right? The fact that when I walk to my car, I feel a certain ease as opposed to walking to a different car.
I thought you might say longing. I thought, well, that I would never have expected of you for it. A certain longing for your car.
But we'll save the confessions for another episode. But okay. for the purposes of exampling, this feeling that we have, we take it for granted, right? Like you and your laptop, Sharad, it's personalized.
Yeah. Me and furniture. Actually, I've developed a fascination for furniture.
Especially since you're setting up your new house now.
Yeah.
And you're born with objects. They mirror you in a way.
I see beauty. I see certain aesthetic quality that, you know, draws me to them, you know. And I don't necessarily see myself in it. Though I must admit, when I had some furniture made, I wanted to be part of that process. I wanted to somehow be involved in their creation, mm-hmm. you know. And in fact, with many of the objects recently, I have been involved. And that has been particularly meaningful for me. So in every object I see something of myself.
Mm-hmm. And this is how I guess a lot of design discourse positions itself, right? In the sense that this is you. This color is very you. This couch is very you. This shirt is very you. So there's a lot of you-ness, me-ness. There's reference to an I around these objects.
And the kind of personality traits that are associated with
correct.
Objects. Yeah.
And this is something that moves us in deep ways. Now, this is a nice thought, the idea that we can kind of redesign our world in accordance to who we are. But Marx would pose the question and challenge us to think if whether this is more restricting than it is freeing, right? Because we can only, as a result, relate to or go to or be comfortable in places of specific objects and not, say, the broader world, right? So on one hand, it's appealing because it tugs into this impulse to want to personalize these objects, to seek relationships with objects in that way. But on the other hand, it shackles us a lot more.
So we have that basis, right? We call kind of understand what a fetish might mean, or at least we have a kind of working definition. Where we go from there?
Okay, so that's the Marxian trajectory of trying to unpack how these fetishes mean for us. Freud, on the other hand, is going to look at sexual fetishes. So in his essay, which maybe I'll reference later, he talks about feet fetishes. He seems to think that's common during his time. Even the glance of a nose, right? The reflection of light on someone's nose can be a fetish. He's looking at fetishes in relationship to bodily organs. And this could be organs that are even normal. You can even fetishize an object that is a typical sexual object, right? So even the breasts can be fetishized, right? So it's not necessarily only the more unusual things like your feet or your fingers. He's going to look at the more bodily, sensual, erotic notions of fetishes, but both have in common this recognition that, well, human beings have a peculiar personal attachment to things, and let's probe on what that might mean. Yeah.
And how does he begin to discover this? I mean, is it again back to his clinical studies? Is he looking at people with some pathologies, you know, that had come to him to problems that they needed solved? Is that the raw material for his work?
Correct. So he looks at his clinical experience, which is the basis of all his studies. But he starts off this essay with saying that I can't divulge too many details. So he realizes that quite personal. So he's not going to divulge particular names, because if you look at his previous case studies like Anna O, the Rat Man, these are particular life stories that he's going to re-narrate for his theories. But in this short essay, he's just going to say, well, these are the kind of fetishes that I've come across, and this is why. Marx, on the other hand, is going to explain it from a political economic standpoint. So for Marx, the reason why we need to bond with all these objects is because we're alienated from our labor. He has in mind the industrial context where production of objects are necessary to create these commodities, right? And what we do instead of having a direct say and having a direct ownership over the things we create is that we cast these things out to the market. They become commodities, right? So material, raw material gets reconfigured. They enter capitalism and they get a certain glow that's going to become the commodity fetish. We, rather than getting the objects directly, have to enter the market in order to purchase these products. So we spend our bodily energy, our physiological discharges, creating value for other people. So in the end, the only way we can get the value of our work back is through the market. So that's the strange, alienating route that we are forced on to relate to our objects that creates this need for us to personalize the things around us, because we spend most of our working days with little say over what we do with our hands and bodies and producing the value we do.
Yeah. You know, some people might say, well, you know, this sounds like a lot of talk about things that are really quite ordinary and explicable in the simplest of terms. After all, you know, we work and we earn money, and from that money we buy objects, most of which we can't produce ourselves. I mean, it's not like, you know, I can make a carton of milk or go out and make a stiletto that I need or whatever. You know, I can't do this myself. I mean, unless I'm a cobbler, which I can do at least the shoe. And so, you know, why make something so simple, so complex?
Yeah, this is a common response, right, in the sense that, yeah, I can't make a computer, I need one, you know, so
yeah, so I work, you know, for a year to yeah. to make enough you know, value in terms of money in order to purchase that.
Yeah, it's not so much that we need to eventually get items we can't produce, but that our, how would you say, authentic selves, the reflections of our power in the world, is not there. So we need these objects to compensate for that. So the emotional investment of what we do every day, right, which actually creates the world, but we have little control over it, right? So we work, the world changes, but we have little say or control over it. And this alienates us. And what we end up doing is trying to find ways to have objects where we would be mirrored in the objects that we own.
Yeah. Taken as a whole, right? If you don't talk about it in terms of the individual, but you're talking collectively, human beings are constantly producing things for the world, but they come back to act upon them in ways that they maybe didn't intend. I think of technology in particular, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. The way in which we created a world created devices to help us. But just the sheer volume of these things out there in the world have come to have their own logic, and you know, the production of which is also its own logic, and that somehow human beings are now following in step with this logic that they put in motion by creating these things that initially were going to be just their handmaidens, just little helpers.
Correct.
But have become, in fact, things to dominate them.
And this would be one critique of the classical Marxist view, and in particular in relation to commodity fetishes, in the sense that Marx eventually envisions in an ideal society, we would not be alienated, right? We would no longer have the anxieties that lead to commodity fetishes. So people find that quite unrealistic, because like you say, the world is not really in our control anyway, even if you do own the means of production, right? We don't have this immediate, rational, transparent access to know the outcomes of what will happen once we do reshape the world a certain way. So we cannot overrate that capacity. And this is where I think Freud is going to be a good counter check to extend the Marxian insight as well, which I think we'll touch on the second part of the show. But for now, let's take a break, Sharad, and we'll be back soon. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, alongside Sharad Kutin. As usual, this is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Night School. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahman alongside Sharad Kutin, and this week we're discussing fetishes. So we touched on quite a bit of the Marxian picture, and now we're going to get into Freud for a bit of the second part of the show. What are your thoughts so far on discussing this, Sharad?
You know, all these terms in some ways are very familiar to me in having done sociology, anthropology, whatever. And I come back to the technology thing, because partly because it's all ubiquitous. I mean, we constantly talk about technology. We have in popular culture, you know, constant examples of warnings and signs of the world that we are creating and that somehow we've lost control of. But, you know, on the other hand, I think of art and I think of creating beautiful objects. I mean, human beings also have this capacity, right, mm-hmm. to actualize. You think of a block of stone that is carved into a statue. The kind of mental processes that require you to think about the finished product and how to create it, you know, it's not like building blocks. It's like thinking of the negative space and mm-hmm. trying to remove mm-hmm. the negative space in order to create this thing. And it's remarkable how our minds have that capacity, you know, that cognitive capacity. We create such complex things, and we have been doing so for a large part of the last 15,000 years. Mm-hmm. The fact that those things now have a life of their own, having created them, strikes me as, part of, it's a kind of a mystery, and it's really quite intriguing, not in a terrifying way, but in a kind of awesome, beautiful, finally there's something nice about us human beings. We're not just, you know, killing each other, or, you know, and whatever, you know.
That takes me to the mystery of social media, right? In the sense that on one hand, it's very commonplace. Everybody uses it, everybody's on it. But at the same time, we don't really know what it's doing to us yet. You know, so we think because we can personalize our settings, we can personalize these desktops or these images, we're somehow in the driving seat. But we really don't know the new notions of community that is being set up, new ideas of global discourses and identities that are coming up. And
the kind of collective unconscious. Maybe there's a new mind. There's a kind of Facebook mind that envelops the globe.
And eventually realizes that we're destructive. We'll take over the world and protect it from us. So anyway.
And the wizard will be that fellow with the funny hair and the funny nose.
Who's that?
Mark Zuckerberg.
Oh, yeah. This really comes back to this idea of how the world is in many ways beyond us. The starting point, right? The world is beyond us. Things are somewhat changing, disasters escalating, and attachment matters in this picture because we can't face it alone. We need connections, we need relationships, we need a sense of belonging. And this is where the values of our feelings in confronting this world we can't change matters, right? And this takes us into how Freud is going to approach fetishes. And he's going to outline the psychology behind it. And what he's going to point out are two things in any form of fetishes. He's talking about sexual fetishes now. The first is the displacement that happens when we are, for example, drawn to feet. This is a manifestation of a repressed sexual desire.
Yeah. For something else or for the feet?
Not for the feet, for something else. All right, I'll talk about that something else soon. But at the same time, there's this double move that happens. There's also a disavowal. In the sense that we also know that feet are just human organs. So on one hand, there's this veneration, I guess, to use an earlier word. But at the same time, there's this somehow a double register of incredulity that happens, right?
And because feet are not a proper object of, in the mind of the person perceiving it, not a proper object of veneration or love or desire, whatever.
Correct. Right? You could venerate it. Some people might even get excited relegating it or reducing it or looking down on it as you would on feet. So there's this double move in the sense that you see its glow, but at the same time you see why that glow is unique, because it's just a body, another body part. Similarly to fingers, similarly to objects, say even diapers, right? And Freud, as he typically does, is going to locate the reason behind this as linked to the moment of castration that leads to the Oedipal process. So as I've rendered this so many times on the show, think of the child in the sanctuary of the mother, the caregiver that provides this context for it to be able to survive and become a human person, right? Guaranteed nourishment, guaranteed physical protection. There's this tactile embrace that the child is in whenever it gets sad, it cries. Whenever it gets happy, it laughs. There's no gulf between its consciousness and its feelings, right? But as the child goes further into its 18 months of infancy, it starts realizing this distance, and it starts realizing that the caregiving context that it had relied on for so much, for so long, is no longer complete. And it realizes that the sanctuary is not all-powerful. And in that, it has to start fending for itself as a separate ego. The fetish is the substitute, or if to use Freud's term, the memorial for that return to fullness.
Oh, so it's sort of the person who has the desire displaces that desire from the mother.
Because it was traumatic. So another thing too, to note, just a footnote before I get, when you get divorced from your initial caregiver, and the term is mother here, you get traumatized, you have to construct your own ego, right? You can't pee and defecate everywhere you want. You have to start thinking about social norms, and you fashion your ego, but at the same time, gradually the initial draw that you have with that caregiving context gets suppressed.
But why does it come out in terms of an object, right? A mother isn't equivalent to an ankle. I mean, why not, project those desires onto another, person, another woman with similar features and say, okay, I couldn't get it all from my mother. Now I'll get it from this other woman.
That's what we end up doing too, according to psychoanalysis.
Okay, so that's a different process.
That's the same process, but that's this different ebb and flow. So,
and I think a lot of women complain that their boyfriends or partners, kind of hope them to be partly their mothers. But okay, that's maybe a different program.
We've done a couple of those programs too. That happens too, and it doesn't preclude the fetish. So you could be seeking for that sort of fullness and attention, right? However haplessly. But the fetish comes into your mode of sexual expression. So at the discursive level, at the cultural level, you find a socially acceptable partner. Ideally, it will provide you, male or female, the same attention that the caregiver provides, right? But how do you express your body in this process? And this is where the fetishes that we have are residues of that primal period of fullness, right? And let's not forget that fullness is physical, right? Your whole body is alive at that point. You're not just a creature of the mind or your inner monologue. Your whole body was trying to speak to the world. You would use your hands a certain way. You would use your feet a certain way. You would use your back and neck a certain way, right? Your entire body is activated. But as you gradually leave infancy to become an adult, to become a civilized creature, your body becomes dislodged in a lot of ways, right? Or rather, your bodily activity, you become a creature of the mind, right? Emphasis is on rationality. Do you understand what I'm saying? Do you understand the laws? Do you understand what you have to do to be a citizen? The priority is on understanding rather than the free-flowing, polymorphous perversity of infancy, right? So when we latch on desire onto feet, onto knees, onto fingers, chin, nose, these are residues of that attachment to that pre-Oedipal oneness that we had with the world, yeah.
Okay, so is this all happening, I mean, at least in the Freudian framework, unconsciously, that we somehow, or subconsciously, that we are not willing this to happen? It's not like, oh, I understand the trauma now. I'm going to go out there and find myself something to attach myself to in order to make me feel, make that sense of loss less painful. I mean, you know what I mean? Is it happening somehow? Are we all hardwired to have this kind of relationship to the world as opposed to every individual learning, experiencing that trauma and then seeking out some sort of substitute?
So we are hardwired in the sense that these are symptoms of displaced desires. But there is no conscious drive that motivates it. In some ways, for Freud, you can be actively engaging in this activity without understanding why, nonetheless being moved to do it actively and still being able to indulge in it. It's not unlike, smoking a cigarette. You can explain to yourself why you shouldn't or should do it, but the fact of the matter is you're still smoking because that is the kind of bodily reaction that you have. Of course, you can argue that cigarettes are chemically manufactured and so forth, but my analogy is to show that something else is at work, and so that something else is this deeper longing for that moment.
And with the substitution, is the person satisfied? Is it one of those things where, I've got a substitute, now, I'm happy?
Momentarily.
Momentarily.
So Freud says that there's a sense of power that comes into this, that you are, and when you're a child, you really are powerful, right? The whole world pays attention to what you do, right?
Or at least you think it does. Or at least your immediate world does. Right?
Yes, yes. So the slightest word you say is met with standing ovation, right? It's like the first word, the second word, the first sentence, right? Everything you do is first few steps, standing ovation, right? You burp, standing ovation. It's really powerful, right? To get command that kind of attention. Unfortunately, you're not going to have that as
for
adults.
For very long.
So, of course, you look for these relationships that would sort of reflect that. The social circles, you want to echo that sort of ovation. But sexually, it comes into these sort of moments. So this is where I think you can see, you can have a lot of productive conversations between the two, right? So Marx looking at the political economic side of things and Freud looking at the libidinal side of things, where we see the different layers of our connection to objects. And with this range of questions and concepts, you can do a lot of social theorizing. Yeah, and especially now, when we think of how hypersexualized advertising is or commercial society is, right? You see the blending of the two more closely, right? Our alienation from the economy or the world that we are creating inadvertently without our say or without our direct participation. On the other hand, how the society of spectacle or the image industry recognizes that lack and will try to offer sensual and erotic imageries to maintain your attention or fixation.
Okay, so this is important. I mean, what you just last said, you ended this idea you can somehow reverse engineer this understanding of the human mind and desires, that you can in fact, utilize it to control people, mm-hmm. right? And this is because it's the subject of many discussions about things like propaganda or public relations.
You know Edward Bernays, right?
Absolutely, the nephew of Sigmund Freud. Right. Yeah, and there's that brilliant documentary by Adam Curtis called A Century of the Self, mm-hmm. where he looks at how Bernays takes kind of understanding that Freud had about the
mass sentiment, yeah.
And uses it, right? Mm-hmm. And how it's shaped basically all the 20th century from, it's from the very early start. Because mm-hmm. I think Bernays worked for Woodrow Wilson,
correct.
Right?
Yep. And, I think information chief or something at that time. It was a kind of benign title, sounding title.
Well, yeah. I think he was in the Department of Propaganda.
Oh, what's it called?
All governments had a Department of Propaganda because that's what, it was a kind of neutral term at that point.
Yes, it wasn't a pejorative yet.
Yeah, he is the one who created the expression public relations as a way of replacing the then, deeply politicized notion of propaganda. So, he then was the father of public relations in America.
And you would see why, because the First World War had ended and that destroyed essentially the West, before it got to another cycle of war. But I think this is a very important insight to see that a lot of these personalized attachments, whether they're in the domestic confines of privacy or in the sphere of work, actually reflects broader social trends, right? Our lack, our proclivities towards certain sort of narratives or images. And this is why this remains relevant to current discourse right now. So Slavoj Žižek, for example, blends these two, right? He's a Freudian Marxist, he calls it that. Largely because he wants to be able to understand ideology. How is it that we submit to the same sort of mechanisms that work against us? So he's going to show Marx offering as the big picture, and of course Freud and eventually Lacan is going to explain the libidinal side.
Yeah, it's very fascinating because it seems like the basic understanding is that, as creatures we're created, and the processes, developmental processes, lead us to be structured with this lack that, and therefore we're always vulnerable to anything, person, thought that says that they can plug this gap, that they can somehow fill this void in us. And, and it makes us, structures, very vulnerable creatures, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, basically, and this is why, you know, religion is so powerful, or any other substitute, religious-like substitute becomes very powerful. And, you know, that could be consumerism or whatever. You know, it could be a secular ideology. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, it's, much has been said about secular mm-hmm. ideologies. Basically, you know, stepping in for religion when religion, at least in the surface form, it doesn't appeal anymore.
And it has to offer some sort of object. If eventually, we want to see that power manifested in something that is touchable or reachable. You know, I think that reachability, this tactility, all harks back to a time when we had that freedom and power to touch whatever we want, to see that being reached in a physiological way, not just in a cognitive or emotional way, is a core component to addressing that sort of void, right?
Yeah, in fact, you know, what I'm always fascinated by the fact that you could have a religious, you know, or belief system that is so abstract, but when it's part of community, when people take it on, they build around this abstractions all the things you associate with very materialistic cultures.
Yes.
They build buildings, they have ecclesiastical impedimenta of all sorts.
They have small cottage industries too, building these things, right?
Right. Or, so they might even protect the abstraction that is the heart of the belief system, but everything else becomes a thing and an object that eventually can be sold, bought, and traded. Right?
Correct. We're alienated and we need to hold those things. So I think this is the end of our show this week, Sharad. Do you have anything to suggest?
I mentioned Adam Curtis just now and that documentary. It's a four-part documentary, Century of the Self, that starts with the kind of like pioneering work of Edward Bernays. I mean, you might blame him. You might be like the new true evil genius of the 20th century, you know, dwarfing, you know, the likes of Hitler and Stalin, whose influence has waned, but it's really the Edward Bernays that has
propaganda machine is alive and still robust.
Yeah, today, that's right. In you know, in things like advertising and such. But it goes all the way up to current practices, including things like focus groups. And it's refracted in so many ways in contemporary culture. I mean, I think Adam Curtis is quite a controversial filmmaker, but all the better for it because he, you know, provides... he doesn't just tell a story. He has a strong argument. Mm-hmm. He has an argument to make. And you can take it, leave it, argue with him, but there it is. Mm-hmm. So Adam Curtis, Century of the Self.
Okay, cool. For me, I would suggest Capital Volume 1, the earlier parts of it. I think it's Chapter 3. I can't be sure exactly, but that's where Marx discusses commodity fetish. You can look at, and you can Google, in fact, the various versions of this essay by Freud. The essay is called Fetishism. And there he gives a very forthright, at times crude account of what he means by fetishism. It's not always a pleasant read because he's just very, very direct in this. But I think it's so that we can understand it.
Okay, I look forward to reading this.
That is very short. It's about 7 pages, but very packed with a lot of details.
Wow, seven pages?
It's very 7 pages. Oh. It's a very short essay. But he just goes for it in very straightforward ways. So a lot of bodily details in there. In any case, Sharad, you can be tweeted at
Sharad Kutin.
You can email us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com or look us up on Facebook. Just type BFM Night School on the search space. And we hope you've had a good time listening to us today. Once again, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Sharad Kutin, and this is Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.